Hello, this is Debbie again on Wednesday, July 8th, 2015, with the Decatur Herald and Review, beginning as usual for part two with the obituaries. We have Lacey Marie Berry, Decatur. Lacey Marie Birch Berry, 63, of Decatur, passed away at 12:24 a.m. Tuesday, July 7th, at Symphony of Decatur. Cremation rites to be accorded. There'll be no services. Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home Decatur is assisting the family. Decatur, John Ray Rowland, 63, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 12:36 Monday, July 6, 2015, in Barnes Jewish Hospital, St. Louis, Missouri. A service to celebrate John's life will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 10, 2015, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion, Illinois, with Pastor Richard Cohn officiating. Interment will be in Point Pleasant Cemetery, Long Creek, with military honors provided by the Macon County Honor Guard. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation on Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. At the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the Macon County Honor Guard. Messages of condolence may be sent to the family through the funeral home. Mattoon, Dennis R. Spencer. Dennis the Menace Spencer, 66, of Palm Terrace in Mattoon, Illinois, for the last 3 years in Decatur, Illinois, went home to be with his Lord and God at 8:10 p.m. Monday, July 6, 2015, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital, Mattoon, Illinois, after a long battle with Alzheimer's. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, July 10th, at Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, Illinois. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 today at the funeral home. 5 to 7 today, the funeral home. Burial will be at Point Pleasant Cemetery, Long Creek, Illinois, with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association. Rochester, Gary Lee Thompson. Gary Lee Thompson, 67, of Rochester, died on Saturday, July 4th, 2015, at his residence. Visitation will be from 4 to 6:45 p.m. on Wednesday, July 8th. So that's tonight. Okay, tonight from 4 to 6:45 Wednesday, July 8th, at Lakeside Christian Church on Toronto Road in Springfield. Funeral service will be 7 p.m. on Wednesday at the church. Burial will be on Thursday at 11 a.m. the 9th at Camp Butler National Cemetery, where the Inner Veterans Burial Detail will conduct honors. Memorial contributions may be made to the Animal Protective League. Wilson Park Funeral Home on Main Street in Rochester, Illinois, is in charge of arrangements. And that is the end of the obituaries new to the paper today. Next article, Restaurant Renaissance, Downtown Dining Options, Mushroom. Decatur. In 1983, the year Billy Joel released his hit single Uptown Girl and cast himself as a downtown man unwilling to be overlooked, downtown Decatur was in decline. Many corporate restaurants popped up in the 70s and 80s, and people started to go to those. Now I feel people want to connect with Decatur and go back where they know people care and want you to come back. Childress is betting that as the owner of the newly refurbished Lincoln Square Lounge, one of the downtown's oldest eateries, and also owner of the building that houses Anna Thai, which opened in June in the spot he renovated 3 years ago for another Thai restaurateur who didn't stay. The addition will bring the number of restaurants in downtown Decatur to 18, with nearly half of them open 5 years or less. For the Renaissance, many owners credit streetscape improvements that began in 2011 and will conclude this summer with the Franklin Street Corridor. In addition to creating more apartments that feed the return to downtown, Childress has not only redone the main bar area and dining room of the Lincoln, he has just added an adjoining banquet/overflow room in the space Capital Comics used to lease at 127 North Main Street. The Euro plate and Fleming cheese are enduring menu favorites, he said. One block over, a full 6 dining choices occupy the east side of Merchant Street, but the oldest is Robbie's Grill, focusing on salmon and other healthy options. Owner Rodney Powell said that each place fills a niche, businesses that have never seen better, and that he, like others downtown, appreciate the freedom they and their employees have to be with their families on Sundays. Those that are open on Sunday include the Lincoln, Pastabilities Italian Grill, and the Downtown Cafe. Co-owner John Ninneman said the cafe serves breakfast and lunch 7 days a week, but Saturday's better and Sunday's best. There must be 10 to 12 churches within 4 or 5 blocks of here and plenty of places to park, he said. We serve traditional American food and people like it. Ninneman and his wife Barbara are looking for a buyer who will keep the Downtown Cafe going. Open since 2006, Doherty's Pub and Pins has become a popular place for groups to gather. Open since 2006, Doherty's Pub and Pins has become such a popular place for groups to gather that John, Bob, and Jeff Hawkins took out the last 6 bowling lanes last year to create a second banquet room. John Hawkins said customers think the roasted red pepper / smoked Gouda soup is the bomb and that downtown has changed drastically since he became the owner of Robbie's 20 years ago. I think there were only 3 of us down here back then, he said. Now the park looks nice, the lighting's good, and you can walk from one place to another. Order an appetizer at one, have dinner at another, and eat dessert somewhere else if you want. Paco Greenwell said opening Paco's Sol Bistro, S-O-L, in 2010, shortly before Archer Daniels Midland Company moved 350 employees downtown, and the city began streetscape improvements, got his business off to a good start, but that his chicken meatloaf and southwestern egg rolls are what people keep coming back for. He said the restaurant is doing surprisingly well after adding lunch on Saturdays in exchange for giving employees 2 consecutive days off by closing Mondays as well as Sundays. As for what would make downtown even better, Brett Sloan of Sloan's Calzones would like to see stores stay open later in the day. Debbie Hill of St. Nicholas Grill wants some dancing, and John Redden of Taproot has been hankering for a coffee shop. Then Dilly's Bakery opened last month at 231 North Main, serving gourmet coffee in addition to satisfying a person's sweet tooth in almost every possible way. There's something to be said for taking a stroll, getting a coffee, and going back to work, Redden said. I love it that people are coming downtown instead of driving north. We're investing in ourselves again. Warpot Addie Tangwarunkeet and his wife Ratana Anna Darawanku, owner of Mai Tai in Champaign and Siam Terrace in Urbana, said they are looking forward to being part of the mix of restaurants in downtown Decatur with Anna Tai. We have good food and great service, served with a smile, Tangwarunkeet said. I'm going to spell this name and apologize that this Thai name is not flowing off my lips here, my tongue. It looks like Tangwarunkeet. Tangwarunkeet. Who is one of the owners for Mai Tai in Champaign and Siam Terrace in Urbana, who are also looking to be part of the Downtown Decatur with Anna Tai. And that's the end of the article on the restaurants. Next article. Mitchell visit over district addresses senior citizen concerns. Decatur. The cuts have not yet hit them, and this is by Ryan Voiles, a staff writer for the Herald and Review. The cuts have not hit them, but many senior citizens in central Illinois took time Tuesday to tell one lawmaker that things need to change. was the main conversation as State Representative Bill Mitchell, Republican Forsyth, stopped by the Decatur-Macon County Senior Center on Tuesday afternoon to listen to constituents about their concerns about the budget impasse and how it could affect senior service such as community and in-home care programs and home-delivered meals. Leslie Stanberry, director of the Senior Center, lamented to Mitchell that his discussions seemed to be a nearly annual occurrence. This happens every year. They threaten the people who can least afford to lose service. Why can't they just be adults and sit down and work things out? It's frustrating. Mitchell agreed with the sentiment and hopes some of the compromise can be found in Springfield. I don't think you'll find any person, Democrat or Republican, who wants to hurt or make cuts to those who cannot afford it, Mitchell said. It's crucial to play this game. These are people's lives. It's cruel. Well, let's take that back. Cannot afford it. It's cruel to play this game, said Mitchell. These are people's lives. To offset the costs of senior services, Mitchell talked about reforms to the welfare program, which includes drug testing for welfare recipients and banning illegal immigrants from receiving tax benefits. Though welfare reform has not been part of any discussion in Springfield, which has seen the Democrat-controlled General Assembly butt heads with Republican Governor Bruce Rauner over potential cuts in new revenue, Mitchell said he hopes to see his proposals get a chance. Illinois' fiscal year began July 1st without an approved budget. Democrats have pushed for a temporary budget to keep essential services funded through July, but Rauner's opposed to the idea. The Decatur stop was among the three that Mitchell made on Tuesday, with additional visits to the DeWitt County Friendship Center in Clinton and the Livingston Center in Monticello. Though the cuts have not gone into effect at this time, Mitchell said concerns are being heard and things could change in the General Assembly to provide some relief to seniors. People are concerned, Mitchell said, but we have to keep the pressure on people. I'm going back to Springfield and telling people there's a lot of unhappy people about this in my district. End of the article. Next article, web-based map of city code violations ready for use. This is by Allison Petty, a staff writer for the Herald and Review. Decatur, a new online database will provide residents access to a map of active Decatur city code violations, a measure that officials hope will quicken communication with property owners. The Decatur City Council saw a preview of the new tool at its Monday meeting, with the database expected to go live on the city's website at decaturil.gov. That's Decatur, I-L, all one word, .gov. On Thursday, users will be able to search for specific addresses and property owners or to view a map of the city overall. Properties with violations appear in red. The map comes as part of City Manager Tim Gleason's four changes to the city's administrative court and code enforcement systems. He made the changes after the council heard hours of comments from landlords, attorneys, and others at a May 18th study session and then engaged its own lengthy discussion June 1st. The council expanded the administrative court in 2012 to help clean up neighborhoods and provide alternate consequences to what might otherwise be considered relatively minor misdemeanors. Because of the criticism focused on property violations, with some landlords saying they did not know about problems or have enough time to fix them before facing steep fines. The map allows property owners to check up not only on their houses, but those belonging to neighbors. It shows that we really are doing out there, said Susan Kretzinger, the city's neighborhood inspections administrator. Every one of those red dots represents something. A neighborhood inspector has gone out and sighted. I don't think most people realize how many cases we actually have. The map updates instantly when a neighborhood inspectors records a new violation, said Seth Stark, the city's Geographic Information Systems, GIS, administrator. When users click on a property highlighted in red, they can view the name of the property owner, addresses, and parcel number, type of violation, and date the violation was recorded. The pieces are all there, Stark said. We track code violations. We have a map of the city with all the property boundaries. We just had to marry the two together and then turn it on for the public. Gleason said he was proud of the work by city staff to create the database. He commented on the stark visual provided by the map where some areas of the city swarm with red dots. I knew we were in the thousands of violations that city staff are trying to address, but when I actually saw it, it was somewhat overwhelming, he said. Another change meant to improve communication with property owners is a voluntary email address registration. Landlords can submit an email address that will be tied to their properties in the city records so they can receive electronic courtesy notice of violations and be able to register a tenant's email address. Starting Thursday, the registration can be completed online at decaturl.gov or through a paper form available at the city's Water Customer Service Department on the second floor of the Decatur Civic Center at Gary K. Anderson Plaza. Last month, Gleason also said the city would extend the time that property owners are given to fix nuisance violations. Neighborhood inspectors send a courtesy notification letter to the property owner and previously had allowed 4 days from the day the letter was mailed to fix the problem. The time period has been lengthened to 4 business days. A notable exception is weeds violation. Grass higher than 10 inches leads to an automatic citation. Most property violations result in a $150 citation. Those found guilty in administrative court also face $140 in court costs, though it's possible to avoid a court appearance by correcting the violation and paying the fine. Officials also plan to implement alternative consequences for first-time offenders through the administrative court. Corporation Counsel Wendy Mortland said Tuesday that those offerings would begin later this month. End of the article on the map on city code violations. Article, Milliken MBA class takes a detour trip to Germany. 7 hours ago, reported by Chris Lusvardi, a Herald and Review staff writer. Decatur. A change in destinations only added to the learning experience for students as they recently finished the Master of Business Administration program at Milliken University. In the past few years, the group has been destined for China, but instead shifted its focus in May to Germany, where Milliken MBA students hadn't gone since 2005. Student Cesarek Harson of Decatur was looking forward to wherever they went on the trip. Seeing the places in Germany firsthand could confirm what Harson thought they would be like was right or wrong. I wanted the experience, said Carson, who had never before traveled on an airplane, let alone out of the country. We don't have to rely on what you know from the internet. It was well worth it. The first week of the trip was spent in the classroom learning from German instructors at the WHU Otto Bresheim School of Management, said student Tyler Braniff of Springfield. Bresheim is the leading German business school and is ranked among the top business schools in Europe. It was a great experience, Braniff said. We had work to do. It brought everything together from an international standpoint. The 20 students could learn from seeing how businesses operate in Germany, Braniff said. They could see the importance of taking a step back and considering all available options in various business situations, he said. The European perspective is different from what the students are used to, said Mark Minos, one of the Milliken professors leading the trip. Small towns are made up of successful mid-sized businesses in a way similar to what Minos said is and could be happening in Decatur. Their operations are steadily growing with a healthy bottom line, Minos said. There was really an important takeaway. It was interesting to see how the towns have dealt with changing economic times, Minos said. Following the academic portion in Germany, Minos said the group traveled to Prague in the Czech Republic for more of a cultural comparison. Students are increasingly working for companies that are global in nature, so Minos said various destinations for the trip are being considered to enhance their understanding of the marketplace worldwide. We want to elevate the careers of the students, Minos said. The 11-day trip came at the end of the students' 18-month MBA program. End of the article. Next article. Chautauqua Group expresses water concerns. This is out of Shelbyville by Sharon Barricklow for the Herald and Review. A group working to restore the Chautauqua Auditorium in Shelbyville's Forest Park asked the City Council Monday night to take a more mindful approach to care of the building. Things are moving in the right direction, supporter Mike Shanks said. We heard loud and clear from the community. If we're going to save the building, we got to use the building, and that's what we're doing. Supporters told the council vendor fairs, concerts, and other events have been held in the building this summer with picnics, meetings, and weddings on the horizon. They asked the council to address drainage issues that left the center of the iconic round building a pond shortly before a concert in June. The mayor and I got our feet wet, Shanks said. There's no good drainage and water backs up under the stage. That rots the stage and causes more problems than a building we're trying to use. The next stages in the renovation of the building will be installing already purchased windows in the building's clerestory and making the building weathertight. Volunteers will then use donated paint and begin work on both the inside and outside of the auditorium. Shanks also asked the council to not store city equipment in the building after volunteers filled in ruts in the gravel floor. We want this building to be a performance center used on a regular basis, he said. City Public Buildings and Grounds Commissioner Gib Smart said he would speak to parks workers about storing equipment. We can work on that and put things someplace else, he said. Mayor Jeff Johnson said a variety of events held in the Chautauqua over the July 4th weekend showed the building's potential. We had live music. We had children's play. We had a children's play, and they were all well attended, he said. I think there's more to come. Shanks said his piece of business had record sales during a sunny July 4th weekend on Lake Shelbyville. I hope it helps us to see that it's tourism, tourism, and more tourism that helps our town. He said, this weekend was tremendous in our community, the busiest we've seen in a long time. Tourism is our best hope, and the Chautauqua building fits well with that. If you give people things to do, they'll come. They will spend their money here, and that brings tax dollars back to the city to make a better town for us all. End of the article. Local business, area farmers coping with excess rainfall. So is the headline by Chris Luzvardi, a staff writer for Herald and Review. The ongoing rainy weather so far this summer has left area farmers feeling fortunate if their fields aren't completely flooded. They're hoping corn continues to progress and soybeans can once again show their resiliency to bounce back late in the season. We've been watching it rain, farmer Doug Uphoff said of Shelbyville said. All right, we've been watching it rain, farmer Doug Uphoff of Shelbyville said. Usually we're wanting it to rain. In 2012, we would have given anything for 4 to 5 inches of rain. The average amount of rainfall statewide set a June record of 9.53 inches, the most since at least 1895 when records were starting to be kept. Uphoff said 26 inches of rain was reported during June in some areas toward the southern part of Shelby County into Effingham County. Not every place in the area had been as wet, but concerns about the condition of the crops are starting to increase. As Uphoff said, nearly every field seems to have some degree of ponding. We got to protect our investment as best we can, farmer Jim Stoutenborough of Moroa said. At this point, we've escaped any major difficulty. An inch and a half of rain is welcome as corn is pollinating as it has been, but Stoutenborough doesn't want much more than that. He's looking for an extended period of time to finish work needed in the field. Some farmers are wanting to spray fungicides, Stoutenborough said. Farmers like Stoutenborough need time to bale hay and harvest wheat as they focus their attention on condition of corn and soybeans. Some soybeans are turning yellow, but Andy Bolson, who farms in northern Moultrie County, is among those feeling fortunate to not have received as much rain as so far as other areas. We're still not terrible, Bolson said. We're in one of those sweet little spots. You don't have to get far, and it's different. Bolson is keeping his eye on rain gauges, knowing conditions can change in a hurry. It's a long time from being in the bin, Bolson said. Farmers want to be able to spray and protect against the possibility of weeds and diseases. They're considering their options to how to proceed, including aerial application, farmer Ed Leonard Jr. of Niantic said. We can't send anyone out there with the sprayer with mud, Leonard said. Replanting in some spots has been considered, but Leonard said it depends on how much time is left in the growing season. He said various cover crops could be options in an effort to minimize weeds. Leonard said farmers try to prepare their fields to drain normal amounts of rainfall, but not to the extent that it has fallen in many areas. End of this article. An article labeled Prairie Talk, Historic Ball Player Knew the Game. In the 1930s city director, there's a listing for one Charles W. Dressen, D-R-E-S-S-E-N, occupation ball player. I doubt very seriously if there's anyone else so titled. It's a very apt description. Charlie or Chuck's entire life centered around sports, mainly baseball. Born in Decatur in 1898, he first appears playing ball for Moroa in the Commercial League. In 1919, he was hired by George Halas and A.E. Staley to play baseball and football. He played all positions in baseball and was a speedy quarterback for the future Bears. Look at the top row of that classic 1920 team. Charlie's at the far right with a big smile on his face. By 1923, he was playing for St. Paul in a top minor league American Association as a third baseman. He led the league with 50 doubles, and following year he led the league with 151 runs batted in. He was purchased by Cincinnati Reds in 1925 for two players and $50,000, a princely sum in those days. He wasn't a star, but turned in solid performances, led the league in assists and fielding percentage. He once had 11 consecutive hits. After returning to the minors in 1932, he was bought by the New York Giants in 1933. They were world champs, but Charlie was left off the roster. That was the end of his playing days, except for a rare appearance in exhibition games like here in Decatur in 1934, the year he was hired as manager of the Reds. Let go after the 1937 season, he was coach for the Brooklyn Dodgers into the early 1940s when he moved across town to coach for the Yankees. He managed Oakland and the other major league, the Pacific Coast League, in 1949 and 50, winning the pennant. That earned him a chance to manage Brooklyn Dodgers in 1959. To manage Brooklyn Dodgers in 1951. They tied the New York Giants but lost in the playoff to Bobby Thompson's shot heard around the world. Many years later, the Giants admitted to a scheme where the batters knew what was coming. That team, led by Jackie Robinson, Duke Snyder, and Roy Campanella, won pennants in 1952, 53, 55, 56, and 59. Sadly, Charlie either quit or was fired after the 1953 series. Charlie wanted a multiple-year contract and felt he'd earned one. Walter O'Malley, a noted tightwad, would only give one-year contracts. Indeed, Walt Alston, who replaced Charlie, only received one-year contracts until very late in his 23-year career. Dressen went back to Oakland, then was hired by Washington Senators, 55-57, Milwaukee Braves, 60-61, and Detroit Tigers, 63-66. He became ill shortly after the season started and died in August of 1966. With the exception of the Senators, Charlie could and did develop winners. Many Hall of Famers played for him. The 1968 Detroit team made up mostly players he developed. Beat my Cardinals in the 1968 World Series. He is the only person to be on all three of New York City title-winning teams, 1933 Giants, 1941 Dodgers, and 1947 Yankees. So that's the story on Charles W. Dressen, occupation ball player. That's the end of that article, and this is the end of part two for Wednesday, July 8th, 2015. This is Debbie saying, talk to you again next week.